This week on the show, we recap the Patriots' painful season opening loss and take a look at what else went on around the NFL in week one. Plus, the Red Sox are surging again. Boston Sports Journal's Sean McAdam has the updates on the team from Fenway. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Well, to quote a character from one of my favorite shows, that went slightly better than the worst it could have gone. Talking about the Patriots kickoff on Thursday night. He's Alex Lovitz. I'm Alex Parth. You're tuned into Calling It. First week of NFL football, and I did not think we would be starting on this kind of down note, Alex.
No, yeah, it just was horrible. And the biggest surprise is, we've already talked about this, the coaching. There was no adjustment that really worked for the Patriots, and to me that goes back to, you know, how prepared they were.
Was there no adjustment that worked, or was there, I think there was just no adjustment.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they had the I don't think they had the personnel to do what they really wanted to, and I don't think they had any backup plans in case their most important player, Dante Hightower, got hurt. And you heard Michael Hurley last week. He's the most valuable guy on
the
team.
The game was out of hand at that point. I think it was purely on the coaching staff. One of my friends was texting me saying, oh, this defense, it's like the 2012 defense. Look at all the yards they're giving up. I'll tell you something. You want to see what happened on Thursday night? Go on Madden. Create a team of all 99 players, and then just run field goal block on defense every play and see how many yards you give up. That's what happened Thursday night. The game plan was terrible. Belichick got out-coached. His staff got out-coached, and they couldn't adjust. Football's a game of adjustments. Close football games are won and lost at halftime. How you counter the opposing team's punches. And the Patriots didn't have a counter. They didn't change anything. They kept giving up the passes underneath to the speedy wide receivers, trying to put linebackers, trying to put a defensive end in Cassius Marsh on Tyreek Hill. That's never going to work. And then on offense, they continue to try to run the ball up the middle. They didn't get Brady the extra protection he needed on the outside. And they didn't change anything. It's one thing if you come out early and you can't figure it out, but you counter. The one change they made, going off of the no huddle that worked on the first drive, didn't make any sense. Belichick said Friday morning that part of what got to the Patriots was the Chiefs' sub packages and their ability to give them different looks on defense. You know how you counter sub packages? Don't let them sub. Go into no huddle, something this Patriots team is very confident in doing. This reminded me a lot of the Miami game from a couple years ago. It was the Super Bowl year 2014 when they lost to Miami at home. It was a close game. Miami pulled away in the second half. It was the same thing. The Patriots failed to make adjustments, and it doesn't matter how good you are. Once the other team knows what you're doing, they're going to beat up on you. I'm sorry. It's been boiling since Thursday. It was one of the most frustrating Patriots losses I've ever seen. Like I said, it went slightly better than the worst it could have gone because it seemed like they escaped relatively healthy. They're not going to put Dante Hightower on the bike if there's anything seriously wrong with his knee. Whether he plays against the Saints or not, we'll see. But frankly, if there's one game he's going to miss this year, I'm okay with the Saints. They don't need him as badly in that game as they do certain others. But, wow, did the Patriots start off the season on the wrong foot.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, it was absolutely horrible. And I think we all underestimated how much talent they lacked on the defensive. And I know that coaching was a primary factor in that loss.
They're using defensive ends as linebackers.
Yeah.
Cassius Marsh is a good pass rusher. They didn't let him loose.
That's a depth problem, isn't it? And that's a roster construction problem, really.
No, because they were blitzing Kyle Van Noy, who excels in coverage. If Kyle Van Noy, look, Kyle Van Noy is not keeping up with Tyreek Hill, and you need a corner on Tyreek Hill.
Yeah.
But I feel a lot better with Kyle Van Noy in coverage. And even when he signed the extension the other day, Belichick praised his coverage ability.
Mm-hmm.
They're rushing Kyle Van Noy at the quarterback. They're putting Cassius Marsh in coverage. It should be the other way around. Cassius Marsh, for those unfamiliar with his game, is a good player. I'm sick of people saying he's the worst player in the NFL. He's a good player. But look, let me think of a good deal. Jason Pierre-Paul is a good player because I watched the game last night. First one pops in my head.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you put him in coverage, he's going to look like the worst player in the NFL.
Yeah.
Cassius Marsh isn't JPP, but he's a good player. He's Chris Long. And there is no reason if Chris Long had been seen in coverage last year, people wouldn't have been going after him. They would have been going after the coaching staff. Unfamiliarity with Cassius Marsh, fine. Only football heads like us are going to really know who that guy is before he gets to New England. But the pass rush problem is they were rushing coverage linebackers and they were putting pass rushers into coverage.
Yeah, I mean, I still...
I don't know if they have a depth problem solely because I didn't... They're going to have a depth problem if this is the game plan they're going to use this season. I didn't know if they had a depth problem because the guys who should have been in those spots were still on the field. They were just doing the wrong job.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I still think talent is lacking in that linebacking core. I agree with you. Probably shouldn't put Cassius Marsh out there in coverage. That's not his stronghold. Van Noy would have been better suited for that. But it's not like Van Noy is this unbelievable option either. I still think they lack a ton at that second level in that linebacking core, and they don't have the pass rush to make up for it. Even if you do send their Marsh, who would probably do a better job than Van Noy, they still can't get pressure on a quarterback who can evade pass rushing.
I thought they got a decent amount of pressure given what they had. Trey Flowers looked good. Alex Adam Smith, Butler looked good.
No, yeah, Trey Flower, Adam Butler, they both looked very good. Even Weiss looked pretty good. He had a sack. They're still young on that defensive front. They still don't have the pass rusher in Dante Hightower available. And a lot of it also came down to their secondary looked kind of baffled. They did a good job. They did fine. But you can't get past the fact that Alex Smith threw for, what, 320 yards?
Yeah, they ran into Alex Smith having Alex Smith doesn't make most of those throws on a normal basis. They did run into Alex Smith having the game of his life.
Although, those deep balls, there was no one around those targets.
I've seen him overthrow that pass more often than not.
Yeah, and if a guy doesn't have someone within 20 feet of him, you better hit him. You're an NFL quarterback.
Did you see Cam Newton miss Ed Dixon in the end zone yesterday?
Oh, yeah.
Wide open.
Yeah.
I've seen Alex Smith miss those. So Alex Smith had the game of his life, and all the credit to Alex Smith. That was a part of it, and that's part of what made it so difficult to the Patriots. Look, the game plan they had makes sense if you're up 14-0. And before we get to the reason they weren't up 14-0, I just want to say it makes sense. They were okay. They were worried about Travis Kelce, as they should be. Very good player. They were worried about Tyreek Hill. Not enough, but they were. That they were content to let the secondary receivers catch the ball underneath, over the middle, give up the 5-yard gains and tackle. That's always been the Patriots' philosophy. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. That works if you're up 14. We saw it in the Super Bowl. It works if you're up 14-0. But once you get down, you get in trouble. They never adjusted from that strategy. They never played defense with any urgency. Now, if they get up 14-0 early, it's a different game. And they didn't, because as bad as the defensive game plan was, the offensive game plan was right there. 4th-and-1, you see 5 down linemen, and you're still going to run the ball up the A-gap? Are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
3rd-and-12, and I know it worked once, but it was a fluke. 3rd-and-12 draw? I felt like I was watching Lane Kiffin in Alabama again. And I understand why they didn't sneak it with Brady. The A-gap wasn't free. Pitch it to the outside. Run the Super Bowl play. Do something different. They had 3 or 4 3rd or 4th-and-1s, and they just went up the middle every freaking time.
Yeah.
Vary it up on offense a little bit. And I understand Eric Berry took Gronk out for a lot of the game. When Eric Berry goes down there at the end and you still have a puncher's chance, the next 5 throws should have been to Rob Gronkowski.
Yes.
They didn't target him once. And I know people were saying, oh, Brady didn't have time to get the ball off. Run that little bubble screen to the tight end you like to run. Mm-hmm. Attack, attack, attack. Who was the corner they were going after on the Chiefs early?
I forget. I remember who you're talking
about. They had a corner. I can't remember his name. They had a corner picked out. They were attacking him early when they were in no huddle. They go out of no huddle. They stop going at that corner. They start going at Sean Smith. Not Sean Smith. Marcus Peters for mm-hmm. no reason. Peters, the only good player on that defense outside of Eric Berry. The lack of adjustments was unlike anything I'd ever seen from Belichick and his staff before outside of that game against Miami 2 years ago. The offensive game plan, the defensive game plan, it took a while for me to realize and probably ultimately disgust me more, but the offensive game plan was so just smack you in the face, stupid.
Yeah, and Danny Amendola, he looked really good when he was in. The offense looked pretty good. Him being sidelined, going out with injury, should not affect your offense as much as it
nope.
did.
You're 100% right. I'm sorry, but I just want to enforce how right that point is.
Yeah, so it did. And that's why they're bringing in more options in that wide receiving core. You know, Edelman going down, we all knew that would be big. Malcolm Mitchell going down, I don't think we realized how big that would be. And looking back to that Brissett for Dorsett trade, that seems like it was something that was calculated, knowing that this would become a problem.
Yeah, and you can't expect much from Dorsett week one. I'm not saying I wanted them to use him more, right. But there needed to be some sort of contingency plan. I thought they would use James White and Deion Lewis as slot receivers in this mm-hmm. game. They didn't do that.
They put Burkhead out wide.
But they didn't really seem to have any interest in throwing to him.
No, you have
these two, and Burkhead's not the playmaker White and Lewis are. Those guys can be. I would expect we'll see DJ Foster on the roster next week to play that role if Amendola can't play, or even if Amendola is healthy. We will see DJ Foster on the roster next week as a slot receiver. But again, he went out and they just didn't make the adjustment. They didn't use Dwayne Allen at all, who I think is overrated, but
he's Scott Chandler 2.0.
They let Martellus Bennett walk, and I understand why they did. They had to act quickly. They didn't know his price would fall the way he did. By the way, and we'll talk about this when we get in the NFL. He was fantastic for the Packers. Mm-hmm. He had a great game yesterday. But you go out, you get Dwayne Allen, they throw that early ball to him where he breaks off his route too early. Brady, that throw is a completion to Martellus Bennett. That's not, it looked overthrown. That's not on Brady. And I'm not here to defend Brady. He didn't play great.
No, he didn't.
But we don't need to get into that because Tom Brady can fix the problem. Mm-hmm. Dwayne Allen sucked early, and then they went away from him. And we didn't see Hollister either. The two tight end set was their best set last year. They didn't bring it in. It would have made sense. Counter the pass rush, bring in two tight ends, look like you're going run, go play action. That was their bread and butter last year when they were struggling. Two tight end set, play action, stretch the field. Now you have Brandon Cooks and Chris Hogan and Dorsett. The perfect, perfect set to run that. You can't have all three on the field at one time. You need the running back for play action, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And they didn't do it. There was just... The GMs and the Twitter head coaches and the Twitter GMs figured this all out, but Belichick couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, silver lining here. They're going to adjust. This team will get to a point where they are the best team in the AFC. I truly believe that. I think with the offense, obviously the play calling was horrible. The game plan was bad.
Atrocious.
But once, you got to think, once Brandon Cooks gets more acclimated with this offense, once Dorsett gets more acclimated with this offense, and once Gronkowski gets, you know, into that midseason form.
Once Gronkowski isn't covered by Eric Berry.
That too, which won't happen for the rest of the season, regardless of if they play again. It's too bad for him.
Yeah.
But you got to think, this team has a talent. It has a talent. And it has the coaching to make up for these mistakes. Horrible coaching today, but the one thing that they do well is recover. You saw it last year. You saw it the year before. Or not even last year. You saw it in 2014 when they played
right,
this
the Chiefs
team.
Again.
We're on to Cincinnati. You know, part of me is relieved, and I know I'm not the first person to have this take. Part of me is relieved this happens week one, and this is their worst game of the season. I also do think that we underestimated the Chiefs. They might be the second best team in the AFC.
You're not. Alex Smith isn't going to play like that on a regular basis. No, if he does all the power to him, but I don't see it.
But we didn't expect Kareem Hunt to be as big of a factor as he is. Now they have another weapon. If he does sustain it to some degree, obviously you can't expect him to go out and do that every single game. Tyreek Hill looked really good. He's a great weapon to have. And obviously they have a top three tight end in the NFL in Travis Kelce. That's a good team with a really good pass rush. They're missing Eric Berry, obviously. That's horrible. But still, great opponent, horrible coaching by the Patriots. They'll recover, though. They'll recover. And we'll see that this week. We'll see how they respond.
So the two hottest takes on Twitter after that game were... A, the Patriots dynasty is done. The season's over. The Trent and Dilfer played it off well, I thought. Yeah. And credit to him. And then there were the people saying that this wasn't a big deal at all, and the Patriots are fine. There's a happy medium between those two takes that nobody seemed to find, and that's kind of where I am. Is the Patriots season over? Absolutely not. Like you said, they have the coaching, they have the pedigree, they can adjust, they can rebound from this, but they can't just snap their fingers and do it overnight. Everything's not fine. There's a lot of work to be done. But I do have faith in the Patriots to do it. And I feel like either people think there's no work to be done and they can flip the script, or they don't trust the Patriots to turn it around. There seems to be nobody who is in the middle. There seems to be very few of us who are in the middle there. And I think that's what's important to remember. Before we wrap it up real quick, I just want to say about Brandon Cooks. I know he had a slow game, but what was there, 5-6 holding penalties on him?
Oh, yeah. He drew a ton of PIs.
Like, he may not have 1,000 yards receiving this year, but if he draws 1,000 yards worth of penalties, it doesn't help me in fantasy, but I'll take it all day. He's that kind of guy.
He's like the anti-Brandon Browner on
offense. Exactly. So that's it for the Patriots talk for this week. We're going to come back on the other side. We'll go roundtable with the NFL. I talked about it a little last night. If you caught it, we haven't gotten Lebo's thoughts. Real quick, we'll go around the games. Keep it right here. You're listening to Calling It.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
So the one nice thing about the Patriots playing on Thursday was that we got to sit and enjoy all the Sunday football.
That was great.
And I did seriously enjoy it. I didn't think I would as much with the Patriots loss, but I absolutely did. We got some none of the real shotgun endings, none of these down to the wire finishes, but I thought we got relatively good football.
Yeah, it was
maybe it's great. Just because I haven't seen it in a while.
It was great. I think that definitely plays into it. It's not great football, but it's football. It's like pizza, you know?
All right, so I did this last night with Matt McCarthy of 98.5, and we'll be doing this throughout the season. Me and Alex will have guests on occasionally. Sunday nights on our YouTube channel, the Call It YouTube channel, we'll just kind of do a recap of all the day's games. We're going to try to slot it in between the end of the touchdown montage on Red Zone and the beginning of Sunday night football. For details, at Callin' It Podcast on Twitter. It'll normally be in there. Occasionally, we'll move it around depending on the week, the Patriots, etc.
Yeah.
But you didn't get a chance to do it last night, and it's week one, so I have some more takes I've developed since last night. We're just going to run through all the games here, give some quick thoughts on each one, and what to expect next. Let's start with the only AFC East matchup, because the Dolphins, they had their game postponed because of the hurricane. The Bills and the Jets. Bills take that one 21-12. As bad as this Jets team is, and people are saying it's going to be historically bad, remember, I don't think they're going to be the worst team in football, and I'm sticking with that. The Bills were right there with them. And now with the LeSean McCoy possible injury, not fun. Not that it ever is, but it looks like it's going to be another long year in Orchard Park.
Yeah, I mean, both these teams seem like they're tanking. You look at the trades that the Bills have made, and Ronald Darby going down yesterday. He might be down for a while, so that trade is actually looking even better for the Bills. You can't anticipate injury, though. Yeah, both these teams are awful. The Jets' defense, however, you know, people want to act like it's a good defense. You have to have good coaching to be a good defense.
It's not a good defense, but they have the pieces that will walk them into it. You said, outside of how it ended, that it was actually a nice interception they had at the goal line early in the game before tackled by his own player, fumbled, some punches were thrown. It was a mess, but...
such a Jets-Bills play.
That defense was okay. Up next, the Falcons and the Bears in Chicago. Falcons take this one 23-17, but... You know, I predicted Super Bowl hangover. I have them at 8-8. Matt McCarthy had them at 6-10 last night, which I think is a little low. There's still a lot of talent, but just barely beating the Bears, that's a loss in my mind. Although I will say, I'm not on the Bears bandwagon as I was accused of last night, but the Bears have piqued my interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike Glennon leading them down to that last drive almost to win the game. If they had gotten that touchdown, hit that field goal, they win that game, and they blew it. And I don't know who that running back was, but he had it in his hands, and he should have made it into the end zone. Definitely some Super Bowl hangover from the Falcons. It's those types of losses ruin franchises, ruin teams. They had their window. You can't think they're going to make it back there. I don't think they're an 8-8 team. I think they'll still make the playoffs probably, but they're not going to have...
8-8 might make in that division.
That's true. Who else?
Saints, Panthers.
They got the Bucks too, don't they?
Oh, they got to. You're right.
I think
right.
The Bucks are going to come out there. But they can sneak in. I don't think they're making the wild card. I like the Eagles and who's the other team I have? It may be someone from the NFC West. Probably not.
We'll mention them at some point this. But the one thing for fantasy, Tariq Cohen, that running back, was fun to watch. And of all the quarterbacks who got ridiculous contracts this offseason, who would think Mike Glennon would end up being worth the money? Somebody who's absolutely not worth the money is Andy Dalton. He threw four picks. Ravens beat the Bengals 20-0. I don't think the Ravens are that good to begin with.
Yeah.
I think these are two dark horses for the worst team in the NFL, but... The Bengals played so bad, I'm surprised Marvin Lewis hasn't gotten a contract extension. That was... I said we saw good football, not in that game.
That was horrible.
I think Jeremy Maclin was the only player when I was watching that game that I thought, oh, he had a touchdown catch, but Flacco was all over the place. Terrell Suggs had a couple. The Ravens' defense looked good, but if you really watched it, Andy Dalton was just bad. That's...
It was definitely more
a joke of a game.
It's definitely more Andy Dalton crapping the bed than the Ravens being good. But the Ravens' defense is better than I thought they would be. They have Joe Flacco. He's proven himself overrated quarterback. But still, they'll be an all right team. That's still the Steelers' division, though.
Yeah, still early. I don't think either one of those teams make the playoffs. Still early in the season. A lot could happen, but I don't think so. Speaking of that division and the Steelers, they beat the Browns 21-18. This seemed to be the theme yesterday. Those traditional underdog teams, the Bears, the Browns, they stuck around. Steelers barely pull out the win in Cleveland. The Browns by no means looked good, and I'm still not sold on DeShone Kizer. I don't think he's their guy. For the first time in maybe a decade, there's a visible blueprint of what the Browns are trying to do. Their defense frustrated Roethlisberger at times. They've got a good young defense. You can actually, they're still a ways away. But for the first time in a long time, you can actually see what they're building towards. Even though you lost, I think you have to be happy if you're a Browns fan.
Oh, yeah. This is a quintessential rebuild type of season where you have to develop your young talent and hope that next year will be even better. They have the defense set, though. They have a lot of pieces. They have a bunch of targets.
And remember, they didn't have Myles Garrett on the field.
Yeah, that is what, he won't be back for a few weeks. So you look at that. This team, it's the first time the Browns aren't the worst ran organization in football. They actually, as you said, they have a blueprint, and they could be good in the next couple years.
The Lions and the Cardinals. Carson Palmer looked old, 35-23. The Lions win this one. Pretty much Lions picking up where they left off last year. Play terrible for three quarters, but stay close and then win it in the fourth.
Yeah, how about that first pass from Stafford? The interception that he threw.
See, but that wasn't, that just seemed to be a miscommunication. And I actually, couchguysports.com, I just wrote a column today about the NFL's practice regulations and how that kind of attributed. We had 27 turnovers in just the 1 o'clock games.
Wow.
So, and I think a lot of that's just these players aren't used to playing with each other, some bad turnovers. But yeah, not a good look for Stafford, highest paid player in NFL history. This was ugly football. Jaguars 29, Texans 7. I didn't think Brian Hoyer was that bad in this game. I know a lot of people were saying it was an all-time embarrassing performance from him.
You mean Savage?
Tom Savage, pardon me. Yeah. Brian Hoyer actually wasn't bad for the Browns. I'm not going to judge Tom Savage on this game because the offensive line was just terrible. And no quarterback is going to look good in that situation. He's throwing off his back foot. He's getting the crap beat out of him. Calais Campbell's on pace for 116 sacks this year after that game. Dwayne Brown, the Texans starting left tackle, is going to hold out. He's getting a big fat check at some point this week.
Yeah.
Monday night football next week, Thursday night football. We know how the ratings have been an issue for Thursday night football. First Thursday night football game of the year, the Texans and the Bengals. That's a hard pass.
And I had the Texans squeaking into the playoffs. I might have to revise
that. Deshaun Watson, pardon me, looked all right, but
he's going to end up taking over that spot.
Oh, no, he is, but if that offensive line is any indication, it doesn't matter who you put back there. They're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, they're
sure. And people say, oh, DeAndre Hopkins was absent that game. Everybody was at the offensive line. Any other issue that team has, the offensive line is going to be an issue. The one of the best moments maybe of the weekend, though, was J.J. Watt coming out on the field.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was, and his brother had a great day for the Steelers.
We didn't mention that. He had, a sack and an interception,
two,
I think?
Two sacks and an interception.
They're calling it Gritsburg now because of TJ Watt. here's two playoff dark horses for you. Raiders top the Titans 26-16. Titans hung in for a bit. At home, though, if they really are going to take that next step under Mariota, this is the kind of game they need to win. They did stay in it, although the surprising thing for me, one of the biggest surprises of the weekend, player-wise, Marshawn Lynch looks ready to go.
Yeah, my only concern is he's 31, 32?
31.
So how is he going to look week eight? He's such a big physical running back. He looked really, really good. But my concern, he's an old running back. Is he going to be able to sustain that for an entire season? And if he does go out, what happens to that run game? What happens to that offense?
I'm a big Amari Cooper guy. Looks like he's taking that next step. First touchdown he had, that was the first touchdown of the season where he dragged the Titans defense into the end zone.
Yeah,
but
yep.
Adoree Jackson, the rookie corner from USC for the Titans, had his moments on him. I thought he looked good, rookie to keep an eye on. Eagles and the Redskins in an NFC East matchup. Eagles take this one 30-17. There was some questions about that fumble late in the fourth quarter, although I think the Eagles are going to take it anyway. You buying in on Carson Wentz?
Yeah, I think he's a good quarterback. I think he's their franchise guy. I also think the Redskins are overrated. People like to clump all four of those teams in that division together. The Redskins are at the cellar, in my opinion. I think it's Cowboys, Eagles, Giants, especially after last night. Giants are definitely that third team. But I think the Eagles are a good team. They made a lot of really good transactions this offseason, and they have a quarterback who I like. The one play I really that wowed me, wowed a lot of people, was when he escaped pressure from the pocket.
That first touchdown,
it was like 40 yards or something. But he extended that play, and a great throw, great under pressure.
We're missing intern Mitch right now. I feel like this is a soundboard segment.
Yeah.
Next week,
yeah.
we'll incorporate the soundboard. There's a soundboard effect for this would be Rams 46, Colts 9. After the game, Chuck Pagano credits the San Francisco 49ers on an excellent game plan. Alex Leibowitz, the head coach, doesn't know who he's playing after the game.
That's like... I, Jeff Fisher calling, he called someone Danny Woodhead. He brought up Danny Woodhead last year.
Right, even though he hadn't been on the Patriots in years. Well, no more Jeff Fisher for the Rams. That might be a good look for them. But I couldn't figure it out in this game. Are the Rams better than we thought, or are the Colts right down there with the Jets?
No, the Colts are brutal. Just a horrible organization. And it really sucks because they just ran their quarterback into the ground. When they get luck back, obviously they're going to score more than 9 points if they get luck back.
I'm not convinced. I think part of the reason they traded for Brissett is they don't know Luck's future status. This guy's gotten the crap beat out of him.
Yeah.
I don't know if he necessarily has an NFL future, which is sad because he's a good player, but...
He's a great player. But that's a horrible franchise. He signed that big extension a couple years ago or last year, whenever it was. And I just feel so bad for him because he's stuck with such a horrible group. Just horrible.
4 o'clock games. This might have been the best game of the day, the Packers and the Seahawks. I think we see them meeting again in the playoffs.
I think this game also could decide who is the one seed in the NFC.
Those are two good teams. The Packers have a defense this year, which is scary.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's always been missing with that team, their defense, pass rush. And this year it seems like they fixed it a little bit. Rodgers has another target. You mentioned him earlier, Martellus Bennett.
He looked good. It seemed really good. Every third down, he was there. He was open. And then the shove late in the game on KJ Wright sticking up for his quarterback. That's a Green Bay Packer right there. I'm happy for Martellus. I would have loved to see him back in New England, but he seems to be fitting right in. Against his brother's team, too. I was waiting to see if it got heated, if the Bennetts would go after each other. The other 4 o'clock game, the Panthers and the 49ers. Panthers take this 23-3, but it seemed to be more of a symptom of the Niners' inabilities to do anything. I didn't think Cam Newton looked good in this one. That was the worst I've seen him in a while.
Yeah, he's taken a step back the past 2 years. And it's sad to see because he's such a talented quarterback. Yeah, and he didn't look great against a pretty subpar defense, which, you know, it's not like he's playing the Broncos or it's not like he's playing the Seahawks. He's playing the 49ers, and he's still only 14-25 on the day. And, yeah, it was just not a great day. And I just asked myself if the Panthers will ever get back to the level they once were at, if Cam Newton will ever get back to that level. And it seems like the answer is no.
Part of the focus this year is they want him to stay healthier. They want him running the ball less. They want him throwing more. Part of the reason they brought in Christian McCaffrey. But that doesn't see – Cam's at his best when he's in that free-flowing mode. And if they want to take him out of it, like you said, I think we may have seen the best of Cam Newton. Sunday night football, the Cowboys and the Giants. It was all Cowboys. The Giants' offense was, even to say stagnant, seems to be a bit of a reach. I've been saying this for years, and nobody's listened to me. That's not a good offense. They have a good player in Odell Beckham that makes the offense go. Eli Manning sucks. Mm-hmm. They need to draft a quarterback there. His career's almost over. I don't think Brandon Marshall's that good. I think his best days are behind them. I don't trust any of their other receivers either. We saw it last night. Giants, they need Beckham back badly. And the Cowboys, and I know there's other issues with Ezekiel Elliott and I'll say what I can't believe I'm quoting Chris Collinsworth, but you'll excuse us if we only talk about him as a football player for the purposes of the show. But that him and that offensive line, that is a scary combination. That they're going 5-6 yards a pop easy.
They've really constructed a great team in Dallas. You want to talk about the Colts just being horrible at constructing a roster? The Cowboys have it figured out. They have their quarterback in place. They have probably one of the best running backs in place, one of the best wide receivers in place, and Jason Witten on top of that. That's a really scary team. It's just a matter of if Dak Prescott can take that next step. And who knows? Maybe that's a dark horse team to finish atop the NFC. Probably not. I still give the edge to the Packers or the Seahawks.
They're going
to
be in there. They're going to be in the picture.
They'll be in there. They'll probably be that third team right below those two, if I had to guess.
You mentioned Jason Whitney pass. Michael Irvin is the Cowboys' all-time leader in receiving yards last night. That's no easy feat if you think about the history of the Dallas Cowboys and some of the guys they've had. So that's everything we saw, things we still have to see. Monday night, it is the opener, so a pair of games. The Patriots' opponent next week is the New Orleans Saints. They are in Minnesota tonight to take on the Vikings at 7:10. Adrian Peterson up against his old team. I will for sure have the popcorn for that one. Mm-hmm. The Vikings, to me, are a team that could go either way. It's all going to hinge on Sam Bradford, which is a scary proposition, but I think Stephon Diggs is due for a big year. I like the committee of running backs they have, and that defense, low-key, has some nice players. And the Saints are always the Saints, especially indoors. They're going to be dangerous. I think we could see a lot of points put up in this one.
Yeah, it should be a shootout with these two teams going head-to-head. I like the Vikings. I think they're still, you know, they're a top-tier team, but they're not that elite level.
Catching the Packers.
They're not catching the Packers. No way. They'll make it in the wild card. They're one of my wild card teams. Both these teams could potentially be wild card teams. Who knows? But, yeah, they just don't have that elite level of talent that they really need.
And we go from a game that's going to see a lot of points to a game that will see no points, yeah. The Chargers and the Broncos. First game as the LA Chargers, although it will be in Denver. Trevor Siemian under center for Denver. The rocket ship will be on the sidelines. We see how locked in Phillip Rivers is. We know he wasn't happy about playing in LA. This one I might go to bed a little early.
Yeah, I'm definitely not staying up for this one. My question is, how much longer does Phillip Rivers have in this league as a starter?
I think he was very vocal about his disdain for the city of LA. Yeah. I think the move probably cost them 2 or 3 years of him. I think he's on the way out soon.
He's got to be. And they've got to look at drafting another guy to take over that spot. Right. And you look at his career. I mean, that mid-2000s, late 2000s Chargers team was unbelievable.
Well, that was LaDainian Tomlinson.
Well, but they had some really good weapons as well. Antonio Gates, you can't forget. Sean Merriman. Like, that was a team that was stacked top to bottom. And the fact that they never won one was awful. Now you have Phillip Rivers in the back nine of his career, and it seems like he's kind of he's on his way out, which is sad.
Will Brinson, NFL writer Will Brinson, the Chargers in the Super Bowl.
Okay, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
It makes me want to watch this game because I want to see try to figure out what he saw.
What's his reasoning? Like, what does this team have?
He likes the depth. He thinks they have a good cachet of weapons.
If they didn't win it with that 2000s team, yeah. How are they going to win it with this 2017
and with the Broncos? I mean, some people have the Broncos going far. Obviously, that defense is good, but they're not what they were when they won the Super Bowl 2-3 years ago.
No.
They continue to lose pieces. They continue to get a year older. Aqib Talib can only defy time for so long.
Yeah,
I'm interested to see what Talib and Harris do tonight. Another year older, another year of tape on them. But the two highest rated corners in Madden, so somebody likes him. That's our NFL roundup for this week. We hope we filled you in. If you missed anything yesterday, we'll be doing that each and every week, as well as on Sunday nights on our YouTube channel, Callin' It on YouTube. For more information, you can always follow us on Twitter at Callin' It Podcast. We'll have those there. If you want to hear last night's roundup with Matt McCarthy from 98.5 The Sports, that's on our SoundCloud page. Well, this was all going on. The Red Sox got back in some people's good graces. Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal joins us on the other side to fill us in on what the Red Sox did this week and what they have coming up ahead. Keep it right here. This is Callin' It with Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz.
Callin' It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Callin' It. Well, the NFL was getting underway. The Red Sox, under the radar, took 4 of 6. Suddenly, they're swooning again. They're playing some of their best baseball. Joining us on the phone to discuss it from Boston Sports Journal is Sean McAdam. Sean, thanks for taking some time on your day off. So 4 of 6 after the scandal, which we'll get into a little later. It seemed after the Yankees series, the Red Sox were heading straight to the basement. They've rebounded again. Although they're still at the bottom of most offensive categories in the American League for the month of September, is the stretch the Red Sox put together this past week sustainable for the rest of the season?
Well, if they get the kind of pitching that they've been getting lately since they left New York, then I think that they can get by with the offense that going in yesterday. They were 7th in the American League, which puts them kind of right smack in the middle. In terms of runs scored, and as we know, home runs have been a premium for this team the entire season, and they remain dead last in the American League in that category. And, you know, that concerns me a little bit going forward, because I think when you get into the postseason and you are by definition facing the best pitching staffs in baseball with the, you know, you're down to 4 teams in the American League, it's difficult to catch up when you fall behind, when you don't hit home runs, and matched against quality pitching, scoring runs the way the Red Sox have to, which is sort of extended innings and three or four consecutive hits and big two-out base hits, that becomes tougher to do against good pitching. You know, even the best pitchers are going to make mistakes and leave pitches up that can be hit out for home runs. But if you're not that kind of team, it's tougher to stretch, you know, string together longer rallies, get three or four guys on base in a row, have a big extra base hit to knock in a couple of runs. It's a tough way to win offensively, but frankly, they're going to have to figure out a way how to do it.
And one of those guys who hasn't been a great power hitter throughout his career, really, especially this season, is Xander Bogaerts. I think he's hitting like 266 right now, just a horrible second half of the season. And it seems like durability has really been one of his big issues. Do you expect the Red Sox moving forward, and not only just this season, but future seasons, to use Bogaerts in a different manner than they have?
It's a good question. I think they look at this as a fairly temporary issue, and certainly part of it was the result of Bogaerts being hit on the hand in Tampa Bay in that series right before the All-Star break. He clearly has not been the same since. Now, you can say through the first three-plus months he wasn't hitting for power, but he's always been a guy where the homers come in bunches. He gets on a little bit of a roll. He'll hit three or four in the span of a couple of weeks and then not hit anywhere, not hit as many for a while. And the fact that he's not necessarily a 25 home run guy, that maybe in his better years he's 15 to 20, is not a great issue. He's still, you know, accepting these last couple of months. He's still a pretty good offensive player. This guy hit well over 300 last year. He did hit 20 homers when he came on a little bit in the power department in the second half. So I think they're looking at this as a combination of injury derived and, you know, frankly, the kind of slumps that players go through. But it is a little alarming, and it does raise the question as they get into the postseason, you know, would they consider having Eduardo Nunez as their shortstop over Bogaerts in the playoffs? Because when everybody is healthy, and Dustin Pedroia is sort of building toward that in terms of the number of games he can play in succession, Nunez is a little bit of the odd man out. You know, if you've got Pedroia at second, either Ramirez or Moreland at first, Devers at third, where else does Nunez get regular at-bats unless you're going to make him the DH and sit Hanley at times? So I think that'll be something that bears watching here in the final 3 weeks as they head toward the postseason.
Once again this year, the Red Sox seem to have be a vastly different team at home and on the road. It's going to be contentious if they win the division with that second seed and third seed for home field advantage in the first round. Looking at what the Cleveland Indians are doing right now, what was it, 14th straight after last night?
18
straight. Yeah. Oh, my God. After seeing what Cleveland's doing, should the Red Sox be worried, and how much would home field advantage affect a hypothetical first round series between the Red Sox and the Indians?
Well, the way the Indians are going, it may not be, you know, it might not be a terrible thing given the issues that Chris Sale has had against Cleveland and the way that the Indians are streaking here in the final months. It may not be a bad thing for the Red Sox to draw Houston as a first round opponent, which if the playoffs were to start today is exactly what would happen. The Indians would get the winner of the wild card round if they continue to hold on and they lead Houston by a half game or a game at this point. So obviously a lot can happen in the next 3 weeks. But I'm starting to wonder whether Houston isn't a better first round matchup for the Red Sox than Cleveland. Not that the Astros are anybody's idea of an easy opponent in the postseason. They're a very good team. They're playing over 600 ball. But sometimes teams match up with others, you know, with some teams better than others. And the Red Sox have played Houston better than they've played Cleveland the last couple of years. In any event, it does not appear as if the Red Sox will have home field advantage. It's hard to imagine them making up the kind of ground that now exists in the standings between both the Indians and the Astros. It seems like one of those is going to be seeded first in the American League and the other is going to be second and be home against the Red Sox in the division series. So, as I said, matchups can be a peculiar thing, but right now the Red Sox might prefer starting with Houston, even though that would mean playing on the road, than they would getting matched up in the first round with Cleveland as they did a year ago.
And as we do approach the postseason, there's a lot of speculation as to what the starting rotation will be once we hit that point. Right now you have Doug Fister, who's one of the best pitchers for the Red Sox. And I've been mentioning this to pretty much every Red Sox beat writer we've had on, but I want to hear your thoughts on it. Is he going to make the starting rotation this postseason?
I would say right now he does. I mean, again, lots can happen in the final 3 weeks. You can't predict injuries or performance. But based on where we are today, yeah, I think Doug Fister probably slots in as your number three guy behind Sale and Drew Pomerantz.
So he's ahead of you have him ahead of Porcello.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I'm assuming that they're going to go with four starters. Maybe they would try to bring Sale back on short rest in a game four. But if they go with a four-man rotation, I would think Fister is three. And if they went with four, it would probably be Porcello. And at this point, and it's funny we talk about this, I just kind of wrote a piece for Boston Sports Journal that'll be up later today, projecting the 25-man division series roster. And I had them in that order: Sale, Pomerantz, Fister, Porcello. And I also have Eduardo Rodriguez not making the postseason roster, at least in the first round, because you're going to have probably 11 pitchers. It's a short series with 2 days off after games two and games four and game four. So, you know, you could certainly get away with a shorter pitching staff than you do during the rotation, where they sometimes go 12 and even 13. So if you're looking at four starters necessary and then start thinking about the bullpen, on one hand, it might be nice to have another lefty out there in Rodriguez. But when you think about the struggles he's had in his first inning of work this year, I wonder if that translates to a relief role. And I could see him being left off entirely before maybe being added should they advance to the ALCS and go with the more traditional 12-man staff.
And the one name you didn't mention in there that's kind of slipped under the radar in the last month is David Price. He's still coming back from that elbow injury. For them to pitch him in the playoffs, and it seems safe to say at this point it would be out of the bullpen, for them to pitch him in the playoffs, do you think they'll need to see him in the regular season first? And what are the chances? What's the latest on him coming back at some point before the playoffs begin?
Yeah, I think he absolutely has to pitch in a regular season game for him to be considered the season pitching staff. And I do agree with you, Alex. I think if he does make it, it would be in a relief role, at least for the first round. There isn't a whole lot of time to build up arm strength. He has pitched out of the bullpen before. Red Sox fans probably remember the 2008 ALCS against Tampa Bay, where Price sort of introduced himself to the rest of the baseball world with some terrific bullpen work against the Red Sox, including Game 7. So he's done it before. It would be an advantage to have another lefty out there. But to me, they've got to see him in regular season action before they can make that kind of decision. He threw a simulated game on Saturday, 2 innings of 16 pitches per inning. The plan is for him to go to 3 innings and about 45 pitches on Wednesday, and then 4 or 5 days after that, assuming no setbacks, you know, step it up to, you know, 4 and 60. And I would think at some point you would have the ability to evaluate his stuff a little bit, see him in a game setting, and make the determination whether he can help you or not.
And we're talking to Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal. Sean, one thing we wanted to get your thoughts on was this whole Apple Watch debacle from last week. And it kind of brought up the conversation of stealing signs in baseball. Do you see Rob Manfred changing the rules at all, given what we've seen this past week?
No. I think that there will be a sort of gratuitous penalty assessed to the Red Sox, probably in the form of a fine. And it might be a fairly substantial fine for a team, you know, I don't know, $100,000, $50,000. It's all sort of Play-Doh money at that point. When you're talking about an organization that's worth a couple $1 billion, I'm pretty sure they can cover that check. Maybe there may be an additional penalty in the form of taking away a draft pick. I wouldn't think it would be, you know, a first or second round pick, but maybe a middle round pick just to emphasize how serious baseball regards this. But look, there are no rules in place for sign stealing. It goes on. It's been part of baseball for decades. I expect it has continued in the aftermath of this discovery, albeit in different form. And I think it'll always be part of the game. So to legislate against that would be almost impossible. I think what he'll try to do here is to make clear that the use of electronics in any form or fashion in the dugout or between the lines is strictly prohibited. And, you know, there'll be all kinds of sound and fury about that. But look, it was, and I'm not in the camp that laughs this off entirely and says that, you know, there's nothing to see here, move along. But it was only natural to assume that some team was going to utilize the technology to do what teams have always tried to do. That is, get an upper hand, get some sort of advantage or edge. And when you have that technology available, people start to try to get creative to utilize it. I don't think it's a major scandal by any stretch, but I would expect that they would, you know, face some sort of discipline this week, and then the issue blows over.
You've had people calling for John Farrell to be suspended, John Heyman going on the Touch and Rich program last week saying the Red Sox should vacate wins. Why do you think this blew up the way it did, given, like you said, the history of issues like this in Major League Baseball?
Well, I think it's got the juicy aspect of having the Red Sox and Yankees involved in this. You know, if this had been discovered between the Milwaukee Brewers and Cincinnati Reds, I don't think it would get anywhere near the attention. But because essentially one rival dined another to the commissioner's office, it's got that juicy rivalry subplot. As to why some media members are calling for the death penalty here in what is clearly not a felonious matter, I don't know. I suppose you'd have to ask them. It may be nothing more than the fact that the Yankees are speaking to reporters about what they found and being all agitated, and the Red Sox have kind of shut it down in terms of commenting on it. They have not gotten into how this happened, why it happened. You've seen public comments from Dombrowski and Farrell in that press conference setting last week before Rob Manfred spoke. But there really hasn't been any other information coming out from the Red Sox standpoint. So it may well be nothing more than the Yankees working the media here and leaking information from their side to try to, to try to win the day in the court of public opinion, and with the courting of people like John Heyman and Buster Olney, perhaps they're achieving.
So, Sean, before we let you go, do you think the Yankees look bad in this situation?
Reacted, as Dave Dombrowski said, you know, the other day in that press conference, said, I've been in the game for 40 years. Sign stealing has always gone on. And typically the protocol is that one GM picks up the phone, calls his colleague with the other team that he suspects of this and says, hey, we know what you're up to, knock it off. And there's sort of a gentleman's agreement, that's the way these things are handled. The fact that the Yankees kind of went nuclear in their reaction and filed an official complaint and protest, has certainly heightened things. you know, I've heard from a number of people that the commissioner himself thinks that this isn't necessarily a passing for baseball, in that it involves two rivals and two big media markets. It gets people talking. You know, it isn't the most it isn't the most positive look for the Red Sox, or by extension the sport, given that one team is accusing another of cheating. But to the extent that there's no such thing as bad publicity, I think Major League Baseball is privately enjoying the fact that this has given the sport a little bit of attention and a little bit of a bump.
He is Sean McAdam. You can read him on bostonsportsjournal.com, which, by the way, just passed 5,000 subscribers. So, Sean, congrats to you and the guys over at BSJ. You can follow him on Twitter as well, at Sean McAdam.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz. We are also joined by Dan Lothian, who first off runs Little Park Media, whose studio we use. So, Dan, thank you for that.
You.
Dan also previously served as the chief White House correspondent for CNN, before that with NBC News, and it was at NBC News. Dan was at NBC News in 2001 during the terrorist attacks. Today being 9/11, we just wanted to touch on that. First off, give our thoughts and prayers to everybody who to this day is still affected. I know a lot going on, especially with the first responders. But Dan, being in the media that day, what was it like for you covering this story?
Well, you know, it was, you know, it's hard to kind of put it into words, because you spend your entire career covering accidents and a lot of things from Mother Nature. And then something like this comes along, and it's at first you say it can't be real. I remember waking up and I turned on the TV and I saw a plane, you know, smoke coming out of the side of the tower, one of the towers. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, is this the anniversary of when the towers, there had been an explosion at the towers before? And at that point, the second plane went in. And I knew right then what was going on. And so I ran to the office, literally, because it was right around the corner from where I lived in California. And we went in, and there was this sense that every noise you heard, you thought another plane was coming. And we were, it's like, oh, something's going to happen on the West Coast. And it was a real, we were all on edge. And then it was a matter of, okay, we need to get to the heart of this story. And it was, they wanted to send me to New York, but we couldn't get there. I mean, we, at the time, we had a number of private jets that the company had on call, and you could hop on those and get anywhere. And of course, all the airspace was shut down, which was, by the way, was another sort of eerie thing, because we were not that far away from the Burbank airport. So we were, as without realizing, you were always used to hearing a lot of airplanes, and then it was quiet. And that, boy, I'll never forget the feeling of that day. It was amazing.
What was your role as a journalist after that happened? Where did you go? Where were you covering all this
right
from?
So because we couldn't make it to New York, I know there were some journalists who hopped in their cars and started driving, but they decided to, the folks in New York decided that they needed to have a presence overseas to kind of test the pulse of the Arab world. What were people over there saying and thinking? And so I was sent to Cairo, Egypt, and was based there for about 3 weeks to report on all things in the Arab world. And it was an odd time, because some of the things that people were saying, things like, oh, well, you guys deserve this, or this was long in coming kind of conversations that we were having. And so it was a tough time. Also, as an American overseas at that point, you're thinking, wow, you know, this is weird. I never felt that I wasn't safe, and I traveled the world much of my life. And all of a sudden, I'm looking over my shoulder and thinking, am I going to be a target? Because you just didn't know, this was so new. So I spent time covering stories out of we did have a small bureau there, so I covered stories out of there. And then I was sent over to our office in Tel Aviv, where I spent another few weeks covering the story from overseas.
What was the Israeli reaction like? Because, you know, the unique bond between those two countries.
Right. I think, you know, first of all, I have to say it was a weird experience just traveling from Egypt into Tel Aviv, Ben Gurion Airport, because it was, you know, anything coming from Egypt at that point was suspect. And so we went through this whole episode. It took hours of moving us around to different parts of the airport before we eventually were taken way out to the end of the runway and hopped on this lit up plane at night to fly into Tel Aviv. You know, I think what I experienced in Israel was this really deep support for the United States and what the United States was going through. And that's, I think, what much of what we were reporting was conveying, that while there was this sort of hostile climate in some quarters of the world to the United States, that Israel had been a friend to the U.S. and was committed to helping in any way possible as the U.S. was going through the difficult time.
So what was it like? Because in Israel, you had the second Intifada, and then there was obviously a lot going on in the Middle East. What was the mindset like when you were over there? And was there ever a thought that maybe there would be another attack carried out or that things would escalate further than they already had?
I think, you know, one of the things, as we were interviewing Israelis out on the street kind of stories, when we would ask about their sense of what was happening in the United States, as I recall it, they would say, look, this is what we've been living with. This sort of fear and uncertainty has become part of our lives. And now this is something that a lot of Americans are going to have to get used to, which was kind of at the time I remember thinking, wow, this isn't what I want. And I realized that has been happening in this part of the world for so long. But it was almost as if, you know, this is kind of what we've been telling you for forever, since the beginning of time, that this is kind of the way that we have lived our lives. And that was sobering. Now at the time, I remember we went into we were trying to get an interview with Yasser Arafat, who was alive at the time, and I remember we were trying to just really get his take on what was going on. And so I was with this producer who, boy, she had cojones. she was something else. And I remember we went to the compound. And a fight broke out with some of the guards there. And at some point, I don't understand what's being said. And she says, come on, Dan. She's just going to walk in there. And I'm thinking, okay, these people have big guns, and we're just walking in. I'm behind her, so the guns are now pointing at me. So I'm scared. Of course, I'm not showing it because, you know, she's leading the way. But I remember thinking, we could die here. And so that was kind of a scary situation. We ended up talking to Yasser Arafat through a window. We did not conduct an interview, but we had, you know, I didn't talk to him. She spoke with him. I was right there. He ended up not agreeing to do the interview. But there was this sense that the world, I knew at the time that things were going to change as we knew it, and that the kind of security that we had come to expect as Americans was out the window. And certainly for a time it was like that. I think things have settled down a bit, but now I think we sort of expect anything to happen where it wasn't like that before. We used to think, well, that doesn't happen here. I think you don't think that anymore.
And we know today the fine line a lot of reporters have to walk reporting on the Muslim area of the world, the Muslim religion and terror related issues. But it was a different time. Obviously people couldn't just jump on Twitter and leave a reply, but what was the response? Did you get any response to the type of stories you were covering, the angle you were covering after the attacks?
No, I did not. And again, you're right. I'm glad you pointed out that it was a different time. We didn't have social media the way that we have it now. And so, you know, we got feedback the way, the old-fashioned way, where someone would write a letter and it may or may not get to me because there were so many channels that it had to go through before I would even find out about a letter. So no, there wasn't any real feedback that I was getting, and so we were sort of reporting in real time what we were seeing, and hoping that it was well received by our audience. But no real reaction that I was getting from the general public at the time.
Do you think you still would have been able to report those stories in the same way in today's climate?
Oh, I can't. No, I could never profess that. It would never. You can't report anything nowadays the way you used to be able to report it. I think, and that's not necessarily a bad thing or a good thing. I think that you are understanding what people are saying sometimes can help guide you in a way that maybe you wouldn't have gone before. But also understanding what people are saying could potentially change the way that you report and decide not to go down certain roads because you realize that the blowback can be much more powerful than you need. And I think that's unfortunate that the public does have that kind of sway over what reporters, and again, it's not to say that they directly influence reporters and they're going to stay away from stories. I'm not saying that at all. But I do believe that you think very hard about what you're about to say in a different way than maybe the past, because you realize the kind of public pressure that can come from just someone sitting on their sofa out in the middle of America somewhere.
We know the effect that 9/11 had on us as a country, but specifically, what effect did that day have on your profession, on news journalism in general?
I think it's, you know, now you expect the unexpected. You know, again, much of, I remember when we used to, you would report on a hijacking that would happen. At no time did you ever think that a hijacking would happen in the United States. It just didn't happen. It always happened overseas. And so there was, in a way, there was kind of this professional detachment that you could have from any kind of terrorist activity that took place because, well, it never really impacted you directly. And now there was certainly this visceral feeling that it can happen to you or it can happen to somebody who you know. And I wish that in some ways we now thought more globally as a country and certainly as reporters. I mean, I somehow, and this takes us down a slightly different road, but we often tend to report, even like storm coverage, you know, we care about it when one American dies among thousands, but not if there weren't an American. And I think that's wrong. I think all lives are important. And so I think that now, you know, after 9/11, we were realizing that some of these things that had been happening around the world that maybe we weren't paying the kind of attention or certainly with the same kind of sensitivity that we should have had, you know, now we did have it, at least at that time, because it happened to us. It happened to people we knew. It took away the safety that we relied on. You know, we used to be able to walk straight to the... If you were seeing someone off or you were meeting someone at an airport, you could go right to the gate and say goodbye to them. All of a sudden, you couldn't do that. I mean, so many things that, you know, you could just hop on a flight at the last minute and the kinds of security measures. Although I did hear recently now that there's an airport that's allowing people to actually go and meet people right at the gate now. I just heard that last week.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that was kind of interesting to hear that. But yeah, I mean, everything, things that we... that we were raised and doing it a certain way suddenly changed.
Again, we're talking to Dan Lothian. After NBC News, you went and worked for CNN, White House correspondent, where you were, was it 10 years after the attacks when the U.S. government announced they'd caught and killed Osama bin Laden?
I was there.
To report on that, was there a feeling of a full circle for you to be there at that moment?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never been asked that question that way, but yeah, to cover 9/11 and then to be in the White House briefing room where John Brennan, who then was one of the president's top security advisors, was describing blow by blow. And I remember sitting on my front row perch in the briefing room and hearing the details and what they could give at the time of how they went in and got Osama bin Laden was pretty amazing. I mean, we had gotten a heads up that something was going down. We didn't know what it was, but typically how it works when you're covering a beat like that is that there are like two or three things out there that are so big that would cause the White House to call reporters in. Kind of thing. And so you kind of go through your checklist and it's like, well, it's probably not this because of this reason. You know what? This very well could be Osama bin Laden because you're sort of, that's on your list of things that it could go down at any moment. But I remember, you know, just getting all of the details and asking questions and there was, you know, I don't know that at the time I was thinking of, oh, wow, you know, I'm bookending this story. You know, I was there at the beginning and I'm there at the end. Because in the heat of the moment, you it's such a huge story that you're really focusing on the details of what more can you tell us. And did Osama bin Laden, you know, have a weapon and try to use it and tell us more about who went in and that kind of thing. But certainly upon reflection, that was something that I did do.
Dan Lothian, runs Little Park Media in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Thanks for hopping on with us to discuss your experience with September 11th.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks to Dan Lothian of Little Park Media for coming on and chatting with us about that. We also want to thank Sean McAdam earlier in the show of Boston Sports Journal for talking Red Sox. We'll be back next week. Probably more of the same Red Sox, Patriots, Celtics. We still got some time on the Celtics and Bruins.
Yeah.
Unless they finally trade Pasternak.
Or sign them. Who are signing them?
It's the Bruins. There's a track history. Anyways, we'll get into that another time. Until then, you can follow us on Twitter at Colin the Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe on SoundCloud. We're also on YouTube now. Yep. Colin it on there. Check out the NFL Sunday recap. Mm-hmm. We'll talk to you again Sunday night. The recap of that. Until then, he's Alex Lobotz. I'm Alex Barth. This has been Calling It. Thanks for listening.